J-Rod.
All right. Thanks a lot, Larry. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Hello, everyone. This is J-Rod Johnson with the Compassionate Manhood Podcast here on KAZ Radio. And today I have someone very special to me in the studio with me. I think I always have somebody special here with me. But nonetheless, this person is very near and dear to me. It's a good friend of mine, but really more like a brother to me, in all honesty. We have Morris Howard Irvin Jr. He's the founder of Mansa Musa. He's the founder of Nadani. He's an international speaker. He's a teacher and a student of meditation and mindfulness. I don't think I can give you enough justice with the introduction. So what I'll do is I'll allow him to introduce himself to you all.
Greetings, world. This is Mansa Musa coming at you live and direct. I'm so happy to be on this amazing radio show with my friend and brother, J-Rod Johnson. For me, it all started with education, so I call myself an educator first, a youth development professional, entertainer, and also a mentor and life coach. So I'm just happy to be here today to spread some wisdom, share some knowledge on this amazing, phenomenal, and provocative topic.
Yeah. And I'm pretty sure, you know, people will get a chance to see you beyond today. You and I always get together and have dialogue about a lot of different things, specifically manhood, masculinity, which leads us to the topic for today. So today's show is called Freedom in Masculinity. Freedom in Masculinity. And initially it was Freedom in Masculinity and Sexuality. But nonetheless, freedom in masculinity is the topic for today's show. And I think let's jump in right into that, right? Because I think it's important. I think it's an important topic. And so I think where I would like to start with that is from boyhood, right? Because I know a lot of times as a boy, we're put in what I like to refer to as the mailbox. And so what happens with the mailbox is we learn along the way as boys, people teach us, or whether it's uncles or peers or, you know, even things like music, even things like videos, right? Even things like magazines. And sometimes the messages aren't necessarily the right, quote unquote, messages, but nonetheless, they're the messages that we're taught or we're given along the way of what masculinity is and what manhood is. But what I found is that a lot of times in people telling us as boys what masculinity or manhood is, they're not really telling us what it is. They're telling us what it isn't. So we learn along the way, in my opinion, that true masculinity is the rejection of anything feminine. So it's like, you can't be a certain way. You can't do this. You can't cry. You can't be emotional. You can't do this. What you can do is you can get all the women that you can. And you can, you know, so there are certain things that come along with what masculinity is. And a lot of times we're told what you shouldn't do, what you should do. But I really don't feel like a lot of times as boys, we're given the true definition of what healthy masculinity is. And so we get these tornadoes of misinformation, as I really like to say, and we take those from boyhood into young adulthood, right into manhood, good, bad, or other, right? And so that mailbox is crucial. And what do you think about that? Does the mailbox exist? Have you experienced that? You're a father. Is that something that you feel like maybe you passed along or not? And I know I'm throwing a lot at you, so let's just start there. What do you believe the mailbox is a true thing?
Yeah, I think it's true in terms of how we've been socialized, how we've been conditioned, how we've been misinformed and miseducated as young black males from our fathers, from our communities, from our cousins, from our family members about what it means. Box, of course. When you don't have the power of reflection and self-awareness, you just go with anything that's passed down to you. So when you come to a state of reflecting critically about things around you, then you come to challenge norms. So I didn't really realize I was living in, left my father's household when I went to college, and I started to explore, and I started to think critically for myself and really compare and start thinking about my past. And that's when it occurred to me that I was struggling with anger. You know, I was struggling with anger and my explosive anger and explosive rage. And after I, you know, continued to deal with it, I started to reflect on, where is this coming from? And I blamed it on my father, right? Because I saw how he had two emotions. He had like joy and he had rage and nothing in between. And when things didn't go his way, he would, you know, he would respond, you know, very, very aggressively, sometimes physically. And it's so tragic because I think I took that on. I don't know if it's subconsciously, unconsciously, you know, and I, and as an adult, I saw a lot of my father and me and my explosive reactions as well. Sure. I think that was one part of the man box of not being able to communicate other than joy or rage.
You know, it's interesting that you said something, because we were talking about the mailbox. You said something where you said that a lot of times, you know, you express this rage or this anger, right? Do you feel like that came from, because a lot of times with the mailbox, we're taught to suppress these emotions, right? You know, as boys, you know, and you know, I know for me, I held a lot of stuff in, and I don't know if I was taught to hold it in or I held it in because I never saw it expressed or how to express it. So whether it's directly or indirectly, in a lot of ways, we're taught to keep these emotions in and suppress these emotions. Don't cry. And so if I'm taught you don't cry, and crying is a natural way to release. And if I'm taught not to cry, then the question becomes, well, how do I release all this stuff inside of me? So again, directly or indirectly, we're taught to keep these things inside of us. Do you feel like a lot of your anger or your, because anger turns into rage in a lot of cases, do you feel like that came from suppression of emotions or not knowing how to express yourself or having the freedom to express yourself?
Yeah, I think it's okay. It's taught to be okay for us to act on our feelings, not necessarily express our feelings, but it's okay for us as men and boys to have temper tantrums, to tear things up, to break things, right? To kick things, to fight. I think that was our emotions, but that wasn't necessarily expressing our emotions, we were acting on our emotions. So I know you and I can both attest, like when you hold things in, eventually it comes out on somebody in a very negative, explosive way. So I do feel like, yes, both of those things are true. We suppressed a lot of our emotions, but then when they came out, we acted on our emotions, and it was usually in a very violent way. So I think our way of expressing our emotions that we held in was to act on them. Do a lot of physicality, do a lot of rage, do a lot of violent actions.
Did you, you know, these are some things, and I know we talk, right? We talk, and I grew up in a household where domestic violence was very prevalent. And you just mentioned that a lot of times there was some physicality, you know, that you saw in your household, not necessarily domestic violence or not, you didn't necessarily say, but the question is, in seeing this, are these some of the things that you adopted in life, or were you, did you have enough self-awareness to say, nah, you know what, that's not gonna be me?
Yeah, again, so, you know, when I decided after college, I decided to get married to the woman of my dreams, and we started a family. We were very young, in our early 20s, and that was a lot to still be in college and decide to raise a family. But I had a lot of pent up anger, and it would come out. It would come out on my wife yelling. I had a tendency to break things. I broke a lot. We had a few apartments that I would, like, my thing was to get mad and run and kick through a window. And this was really real. Like, and then when my kids were born, I overreacted a lot. And I feel like I was out of control. Like, I had two switches. I had joy and I had rage. No, then three is shame. Because after I would overreact and yell and scream and break something, then I would feel all this guilt and this shame. And then, like I told you, I think for years, I didn't take responsibility. We talk about freedom. Like, freedom is a choice. And I feel like for years, I didn't have a choice because I feel like this was passed down to me from my dad. Until I started to take responsibility for my own life and my own choices and see that I had an identity very similar but also separately from him, I started to pull away and I created a lot of space between the stimulus and response. And then I started having a bit more freedom and peace of mind before I decided to react. So initially, yes, I would say yes. Like, I had this rage and this anger even as a husband and as a father. And it took years of journaling, self-reflection, some meditation, just learning my strengths and my limitations, learning my weaknesses and my flaws so I could cope ahead in those moments as a father and a husband, or I could walk away or count to 10 or take a breath before I would let my thoughts, you know, get me into a situation where I will regret later. Mm.
You know, and just thinking about, you know, what you said, you said freedom is a choice, you know, because we can choose how to respond in a lot of situations. And I think that was one of the questions that, you know, I had, you know, like, how free are we in your mind? How free are we as men, specifically black men?
Yeah.
How free are we as black men?
I think if it depends on your definition of freedom. Again, I think we've been miseducated about what freedom is. And just for black men, we associate freedom with free will. Mm-hmm. With especially what 13, 14, 15 in our early adolescence, late adolescence, young adulthood, it's doing all those things based on my whims, based on my urges, based on my impulses, based on what I feel it means to be a man. And it sometimes it's associated with, I think you talked about, like, women and alcohol and doing dangerous, risky things. And for me, if that's the definition of freedom, I think we think we're very free, but that is definitely not my definition of what freedom is. So I would say I think a lot of us as African-American men, I don't think we're free. And by that, I think freedom is when you live life based on your values and you're aligned with your thoughts and your feelings and your actions. And they're aligned. So if you're thinking one thing and you're feeling one thing and you believe in one thing, it shows up. A lot of us, we think certain things, but it's hard for us to actually carry through with those ideas and values that we have, and we struggle. And then we turn to the free will types of freedom as an outlet, right? Because we're afraid to really face what true freedom is, which is, again, living, you know, based on your values and being true to yourself. Hmm.
And I can't really recall how it goes specifically, but you and I have had a conversation before about there being a difference between how was it freedom of choice and free to choose?
Yeah, so it's the difference between the freedom to choose and choosing freely.
There it is.
So would you like me to break that down?
Please break it down till it can't be broken.
So let's start with choosing freely. Choosing freely would be J. Rod Johnson and Morris Howard Irving Jr. We live based on our neighborhoods and our communities. We live based on what society tells us. We live in a very external way. And we live as a reaction to everything around us. That is choosing freely. I think freedom to choose is when you pause and you reflect and you take the real time to figure out, if I isolate myself from everybody around me, all my influences, family, friends, society, like, how do I want to live? What do I want to be? And what do I want to pursue? So freedom to choose, it takes a lot of skill, it takes a lot of patience, and it takes a lot of self-awareness to make choices from the inside out, which comes from your true values, not the outside in. Family, community, society. And freedom to choose is a lot more work.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the key things that you mentioned in there, in terms of like, you know, when you say it's a lot more work, that's self-awareness, right? Because it's like you said, a lot of times we learn things, but until we develop a certain sense of self-awareness, we can't deviate from that script, good, bad, or other. And so it's like, you know, we take these things through life because we haven't developed the self-awareness that allows us to pull away from things that really aren't who we are. I mean, let's be honest, you know, as our fathers only gave us what they had to give, right? And so in return, we give what we have to give, right? But if you know, along the way, if we do some self-work, if we're fortunate enough to encounter some people and some things and some places that allow us to take the journey inside and do some self-work, then we can develop a sense of self-awareness. Mm-hmm. But that self-awareness isn't something that everybody has, or isn't something that everybody develops, you know. And so how do you suggest one gets that? If their father gives them what they had and it's not enough, how do I know, number one, that I need to develop self-awareness, and number two, how do I go about getting it, obtaining it?
Yeah, how do I know I need to develop self-awareness, and how do I go about attaining it? I think for me, I realized, even though I had a college degree, I had a family, it was still something about my past that was haunting me. Because they say if it's hysterical, it's historical. I'll say it again. If it's hysterical, it's historical.
What does that mean?
Which means I was wondering, why was my reaction so strong to the people I loved the most? And why was I, after I had these strong reactions to my wife and to my children, why was I like doing so much self-violence to myself? Because after I would react from this place of, right, a man is supposed to, you know, keep his wife in check, and a man is supposed to keep his children in check, why would I feel so miserable about it? So to me, your feelings are messengers from above. And I kept having these strong, intense emotional episodes, and I was stuck and I was confused to what was the source. So to me, my feelings were my way in to like a deeper dive into my self-awareness and to where these things came from. And as I really started to dive into my emotions, I read a book called Emotional Resilience. Mm-hmm. And the title was Telling the Truth About Your Past. And it was a quote that says, the truth may hurt, but it heals. And I realized I was hurting a lot and I wanted to start healing. So I started to be real with myself the moment I picked up that book, and the moment I started to be very, very critical about my actions and I started the journaling process. That's when I realized awareness was important, my feelings. And then my first step, or my first action into healing, was my journaling and my self-reflection. And it started with my emotions. I don't know if that makes sense.
No, that makes perfect sense to me. I just hope it makes perfect sense to everyone else, because I think that's a crucial statement, you know, in its totality. Yeah. But prior to that, do you feel like you weren't free to express your emotions, or you weren't free to cry? You know what I mean? Like, were you raised to not cry in your household?
Well, if we take it back to my childhood, I remember, I love her. My grandma, she would babysit me, and I remember there was a time where I fell, right, and I skinned my knee and I cried. Of course, she said some curse words at me and told me to get up. And I remember that moment, you know, because your grandmother is a very important figure in your life. And again, back to my father, you know, I didn't have any brothers, but my father, I never saw my dad cry. So I'm looking at my father, and I had some time around my uncles, I had some time around my cousins, and I didn't see any expression of emotion. And I knew I was very, I knew I was different from my cousins. I knew I was different from my friends. I knew I was different from the young men around me, because I have a sensitive spirit. But again, you don't know these things. You just kind of grow up and survive. So I did feel like the only emotion I could express was like, you know, laughter, cracking jokes, mm-hmm. playing the dozens, or I'm angry and I'm ready to fight you. Mm-hmm. I think there was no place for I'm worried, I'm concerned, I'm frustrated, I'm scared, I'm apprehensive. I didn't know what those words meant. Mm-hmm. But there was no middle ground. It was either I'm happy, I'm laughing, everything's cool, or I'm ready to go off. Mm-hmm. Because I watched that around me. And again, I felt like either I could submit to it or I could rebel from it, which is not freedom either. When you submit from something or you rebel away from something. So we can get into that later about submission versus rebellion.
You know, it's funny that it's not funny. It's interesting that you say that, because if I think about it, I think I may have seen my father cry twice in my life. I think I heard him crying from like behind the closed door once when I was maybe about 8 or so. I think, and then I saw him cry once. Him, you know, there had been some challenges in the marriage with my mom, and they had some issues, you know, out in public one day. They were just kind of, they gotten into it, and she was saying she was leaving, and you know how that go. Hey, one thing about a woman, the toughest man gonna break down if it comes to a woman that he loved. And I think I saw him, you know, crying in that moment, but I might have been about 11, no, maybe younger. Mm-hmm. But the next time I saw my father cry was in 2017 when my brother passed away. Mm-hmm. So from 9 to maybe 10 or 11 to, you know, 2017, I may have only seen my father cry twice. And so I don't know that, I can't recall whether I was deliberately or specifically told, don't cry, don't cry, don't cry. But what I do know is I wasn't shown that it was okay to cry unless you were getting a whooping, you know, one of those, no. I give you something to cry for moments. Yeah. And so I think that was something that I kind of took into my fatherhood, my life as a father, not like you're not supposed to cry, you know, but you cry when I give you something to cry mm-hmm. for. But then somewhere along the way, self-awareness, right? I learned something different. And then I began to teach my sons differently, because like we said, you know, a father can only give what he has to pull from. Mm-hmm. And I think because I was able to learn some things and get around men where I learned to be different, I was able to give something different to my sons. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, other than that, I think I was just giving from what I had to give, you know, like most fathers do.
And yeah. Let's be honest, you know, this is not about right or wrong, right? That's this right. is an exploration. This is a conversation where we're just exploring these ideas. So I'm not here to condemn anyone, including my upbringing.
That's right.
I took a lot from my upbringing. It taught me a lot about how to survive, how to be creative, how to be resilient. I love my dad. I love all my family members and what they poured into me. But at the same time, I think it's important for us to create our own way as well. And I believe in integration. You know, we can take what our parents and that generation has given us, and we can innovate and create a better life for our own children. So again, I just want to put that out there. Like, I love, you know, a lot of things about my upbringing. You know, I love that my father was a protector. I love how he was a provider. But it's also a mourning and a bit tragic that, like you said, he only had what was given to him. And, you know, his interpersonal effectiveness skills were very poor, and he really couldn't, still to this day, I love my father to death. It's just hard for him to articulate a thought or emotion. And I'm sure it's something around, will I present myself as weak? Mm-hmm. And I really feel like vulnerability is a strength. Vulnerability is not a weakness.
Absolutely.
But I have a few questions too. I want to take this in a certain direction. Is that okay?
Yeah, Brother man. Jay? We're here to have a conversation.
So I do want to hone in on the sexuality part.
Okay.
In terms of masculinity.
Okay.
And maybe I'll ask you first, in terms of freedom with sexuality and the role of women in that, and the role of, you know, is it, did you have an idea about what it meant to be masculine, and now do you have a different idea of what it means to be masculine around sex and relationships and how you viewed your sexuality and your confidence?
I saw you try to keep the straight face on that. Yeah, well, here's the thing. I'll say I did have an idea. Now, the thing is, where did that idea come from is what I wonder.
And did you own it?
Sure. Because in my mind, it was just to be, you know, to have as many women as you wanted. You know what I mean? And what's interesting is because I grew up in a two-parent household. So it wasn't like I saw my father parading women in and out of the house. You know, sure, along the way, you know, there were some indiscretions committed, but my father never set that example of just being the biggest womanizer, you know, in my eyes, you know what I mean? So somewhere along the way, I developed that identity, maybe through peers. I'm pretty sure that played a big part in it, you know, and so, you know, where that came from, I'm not specifically certain, but I did. I owned that, and for a long time. And then at the same time, too, there was a period in my life where I had sexual encounters, or I was sexually molested by my babysitter. And so I feel like, you know, I shared that story with my mom, how, you know, with that happening at about 9 years old or so, 9, 10 at the most, but 9, I believe. I believe that impacted me in ways that I had no idea it impacted me. It wasn't until I was 30 plus years old that I realized those sexual encounters had affected me for every relationship that I had with a woman from my first girlfriend beyond. Because at 9, I didn't have a girlfriend. I just had that encounter. And so it gave me something that I searched for until I was able to understand it. I was basically chasing a ghost. I was chasing something I was never gonna attain again. And it wasn't until I was 30 something years old. But I did, I owned, to go back to the question, I owned that part of the masculinity for myself to have as many women as I felt I wanted to conquer.
Like a conquistador.
Right, to conquer, right. But somewhere along the way, and I think, you know, you and I have had conversations about this, and I have, you know, good friends who are married men. I believe I'm the only single man out of all my friends, and I have friends like you and Steve and Dave Gully, you know, that you guys have been a great example of what it looks like to have a healthy marriage and what it looks like to want to desire to be with one woman. And somewhere along the way, you know, I assimilated that, right? Because I believe in a lot of cases it's possible for someone to assimilate through association. And so I think in associating with you guys as married men and having a desire to assimilate the things that I've seen, the examples that I've seen, you know, at this point in my life, I desire to have, you know, one woman. I desire to have a relationship that I can pour my all into because I have a lot to give, man. And so that's a part of me that I've owned in the second half of my life because now I'm 47. I'm not 23 anymore. I'm not 27 anymore. You know, those were things that I did in my 20s, early 30s. But now at 47, I'm different. So I still own that part of me, but it's a different part of me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Beautiful. It sounds like it's complicated, right? It sounds like, again, we talk about freedom. And when we have, you know, so many influences in our lives, again, it starts in the home. Then it starts maybe with our family members, our extended family members, the neighborhood that we're born in, you know, the pop culture and the things we're exposed to. And then we get to school, the certain environments we're exposed to in school and different experiences that happen to us that are unfortunate, like you spoke on. And it seems like that's what I'm saying. I think freedom is so elusive. And I think we have a miseducation of what that really is. But it sounds like you started to really have a sense of discernment as you got older and you started to really critically analyze your life, past, present, and future, and you started to more so have that freedom to choose as opposed to choosing freely. And it's interesting that I was also molested by my babysitter. And it's funny, I think we went different ways, because when that happened to me, I actually didn't want to be bothered with females. Even when I became a teenager, I'm a pretty okay looking guy, you know. But I felt like when it came down to being intimate with females, I didn't want any parts of it. I was really traumatized, so I didn't go to the sexual promiscuity part of it. I kind of went the other way. Like, I didn't want to have any type of interactions with females. So it's interesting, you know, something can happen to two individuals and they still, you know, can make different choices. But, you know, when I did go to college and I became a Muslim, so I was very devout in my religion. And, you know, college is, you supposed to be, you know, drinking alcohol and partying and kicking it and soy world oats, and I was doing none of that, you know. And there was a lot of pressure. I remember when I told everybody I was going to get married and I was still in college. And I struggled with that because I was looking for some validation from my dad, from my cousins, from close friends. And it was just like, what are you doing? Mm-hmm. Are you crazy? Like, are you, like, you giving up all that freedom? Mm. And again, I think it really goes down to what we define freedom as. That's, and right, you know, freedom to choose or choosing freely. But again, I think I went against the norm. And I love it, and I'm a better man for it. But I struggle, even in my 20s, with that idea of, am I supposed to be getting this out of my system? Mm-hmm. What am I supposed to be getting out of my system? Mm. So again, none of this is about right or wrong. It's just about how we've been socialized to, you know, to kind of move through life based on the stages and the expectations of us being men.
Yeah, and it's interesting that you say that, right? Because here it is, you know, in your 20s in college, you're married. Right. Mm-hmm. And in your mind, based on what society or where, you know, whomever, wherever these messages come from, you're supposed to get this stuff out of your system. But you're married in college. And I think about your son. Right. Because Idris, you know, your family is very near and dear to me, and as mine is to you.
Absolutely.
And so Idris, phenomenal young man. He has a girlfriend that he's been with for a while. Now he's in college. And he's thinking about getting married.
Yeah.
Right? And so it's like in his 20s, right? And so you might have somebody saying, you gonna give up all that freedom, mm-hmm, for one woman? You still in college. He just crossed Alpha Phi Alpha, right? So you know that comes with a lot of things.
Expectations
mm-hmm. is a great word, right? But here it is. He has a definition of freedom that allows him to be comfortable enough to say, nah, freedom to me is marrying this one woman.
Let's go.
Committing to this one woman.
Let's go.
And not only that, because it's based on the example that has that has been set by his father, by you. Mm. Right? So you could have taken the information from society or from wherever and said, I gotta pull a coming to America. I gotta sow these royal oats, right?
In the face.
And passed up on, like you say, being with the woman of your dreams. Cause your wife is a phenomenal woman, mm-hmm. right? And Idris could do the same thing, and he has a phenomenal young lady as well.
Mm.
So again, like you said, it depends on the definition, but at the same time, I believe it also depends on the example that has been set, right? What do you think about that? Do you agree with that?
And I think, you know, how you so eloquently put it, you know, my son and my daughter is actually looking at engagement rings with her boyfriend, and they're really serious. And my wife and I are like, wow, we reflect, like, they're the same age that we were when we decided to get married. Example. That was the reality that my kids saw, you know, for a long time in our household. And even though a lot of their friends were from blended homes and broken homes and single parent households, including our family members, they were looking at the example that their parents set for them. And this is not about right or wrong, mm-hmm. but it was just about conditioning and socialization and how that had a really deep, meaningful impact on our children.
Mm. But now, and I'm thinking about when we're talking about the example, when we're talking about the example that has been set, right? A lot of people don't have the examples that your son or your daughter or my sons or my daughter has or have or has had, you know, in the past. And when I think about that, it makes me think about two things that are a huge influence on our young people today. Number one, pop culture. And number two, music. And so, you know, because I think those things have a huge influence on how freedom is defined for certain people, especially young people who have not developed the self-awareness needed.
Discernment, yeah.
You know what I mean? And so what do you think about that? How does pop culture and how does music attempt to define what freedom is for our young people today? And two-part question, how do they combat that if they don't have the self-awareness or the skills to do it?
Whew, wow, that's a heavy. I think the first one about, you know, because both J-Rod and I are in the schools, in the communities, like working with young people is our passion. So I think about when I, because I have a lot of mentoring groups on young males, and I, you know, and we talk about music, and you can see in their language, you can tell the songs they're listening to. They talk about Draco, right? You know, they talk about, you know, sipping on syrup. They talk about jumping in and out of foreigns, right? And these are all, you know, a lot of the rap lyrics, you know, that their young rap stars, you know, are kicking. And not to say, you know, some of the other stuff is not positive, but, you know, I think giving them a certain image of what it means to be free, of what it means to kind of be in style, what it means to be relevant. A lot of these young men, you know, talk about, you know, I don't want to like oversimplify, but I hear it a lot, you know, the same verbiage, you know, of the foreign cars and and you know the syrup and the Dracos, and I think if they don't have those strong influences, because my son and daughter listen to that music as well, but again I think they have more of a balance, and they could kind of decipher between what was real and what was not. But yeah, and with the young ladies, I remember one summer they poised it as a hot girl summer, right? They was pumping them hot. It's a hot girl summer. It's a hot girl summer, and again subconsciously, unconsciously, you had the little babies walking around talking about it's a hot girl summer. So let's not underestimate the power of what we listen to and the power of what we see and how it affects our brain, right? How it affects the brain waves and our energy and our vibrations and what we choose to do. So yes, I think as a young person, right, you want to listen to music. Like when we were young,
sure.
You know, I remember NWA, but we also had Public Enemy. I feel like we had a lot of diversity in what we listened to on the radio. And I was different. And your second question was, how do you combat that if you're a kid who you don't have many positive influences? Yeah. All you look to is pop culture?
Yeah, yeah. Because, you know, pop culture,
that's huge,
defines, you know, and that may not be something that there's an answer for, but I think that's a question nonetheless. You know what I mean? You know, how do we help our young people to combat that? You know?
I think for me, when I'm having conversations with young people, my way in is their music. But I don't come at it from a judgmental perspective. I come at it from a critical perspective or some curiosity. So let's have a conversation. Let's print out some lyrics of your songs. Let's print out some lyrics of the songs that I like, and let's have a conversation. Let's have a debate about it. So what young people don't like is when they have to submit to what adults are doing, or they have to, or they like when they have to rebel out and they think that's freedom, but it's not. That's another form of dependence. But when I meet kids where they're at and I explore their world, their music, their fashion, and their culture, and we talk about some of the positive aspects, then they'll let down some of their defensiveness, and I challenge them about some of the problematic aspects of what they're listening to, what they're watching. And then, you know, we have a conversation from a place of mutual respect, and that's my way in.
Because a lot of times as adults or mentors or teachers or educators or whatever, we want to insert ourselves into the lives of young people, but we don't want to delve into their world to do it. We just want to try to pull them out of the things or the places or the habits or the ideas that we feel like as adults are the quote unquote wrong ideas or the bad ideas, but we don't want to go into their world to do it. And so it's like, I don't think that's realistic, personally. We, like you say, we have to meet people where they are. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't mean I have to adopt or your practices or your habits or start listening to your music. But it might mean that I may need to give your music a listen to in order to get an understanding of where it is you're coming from or why you're a certain way. You know, because whether we want to believe it or not, yes, music has a huge influence on the behaviors of young people. And a lot of times they don't even know it. Mm-hmm. Because music is the only thing that can enter into our minds without our permission. And so they're inundated with a certain type of music, then it's going to have an effect on their behaviors, good, bad, or other.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And so it's like, you know, the ABCs, you know, that's one of the first things we learn to rhythmically remember, A, B, C, D. It doesn't matter what age you are, you're going to sing that same cadence, you know, happy birthday, before Stevie Wonder.
You sound like a human cheek. Say that again. Happy birthday.
But my point is, music can enter your subconscious without your permission. And so if it can enter your subconscious without your permission, that means it's going to have an effect on the way that you behave, on the way that you think, on the way that you speak. We see it, the way that you dress, you know, your habits, you know. And so we have to go into the world of young people sometimes to get an understanding of why they are the way that they are.
Yeah, that was beautiful.
Yeah. And so... and I think, you know, as we just kind of coming around, you know, the corner, we're going to be closing out here in not long. I don't know. I know you said you had a couple questions you wanted to jump in. I wanted to make certain I gave you a chance.
No, that was perfect. I think I just wanted to explore that and maybe talk about our relationship as black men, our brotherhood, our love for each other, our affection. I mean, I know I use the word, we have intimate conversations, and I'm okay to use that. So maybe we could talk about the evolution of our relationship and how it was the evolution of compassion and manhood and so much more for ourselves and our connection. And I think our relationship is really helping other communities and other families heal because of the work we're doing on ourselves. So I think our relationship is beautiful and is a true example of the definition of freedom, especially as black men.
Oh, I would agree. I would agree, and which is interesting because, you know, we've, just like any relationship, there's been ups, there's been downs, but never to a point where, and I think, again, because there were a lot of things that we have learned from each other over the course of it, we were able to navigate our indifferences or navigate through these things in healthy manners.
Mm-hmm.
And it's always been about love. And I think the beauty of that is that's a conversation that we're not afraid to have, whether it be with each other or in the presence of others, to be able to say, no, this is my brother and I love you, man.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because you don't really... If a lot of times, if we aren't conditioned or taught as men to express that type of emotion, or if we're taught to the opposite, like you don't do that, then it's not only tough, but it's something that you just don't see. And I think that because we've been able to kind of learn along the way together, we spent a lot of time working together, so we did a lot of trainings together. And outside of that, you know, within our own organizations, we've learned, you know, we've practiced mindfulness, we've practiced social emotional learning skills. And so we've been able to just kind of be students of manhood, you know what I mean, as well as teachers of it to one another.
Yeah, beautiful. And I think there's a few stories that attest, you know, we have a lot of stories.
A lot.
We have a lot of stories.
A lot.
But the story I want to highlight is a story, because we both, you know, practice restorative justice. And, you know, restorative justice is being able to repair harm. That's all it is. If you make a mistake, if you mess up, in your personal life, with your family members, your professional world, you have to have the tools to clean it up, right? Because it's easy to go off on somebody and mess up, but it's hard to eat some of that humble pie and correct your mistake and repair the relationship.
Sure. Especially
so a time,
as a man. Mm-hmm.
Especially as a man with all these conditions and expectations and socializations of what it means to be a man. It's hard to let go. And freedom is also about letting go, too. Situation at the job, me and J-Rod worked together, and I overreacted on someone who's really my friend today. I overreacted and you know, I expressed some sense of anger and frustration, and I embarrassed a coworker, and I was in a position of power. Like I was the education director, and I know we had a conversation. I humiliated a coworker in a very public way, black female. And I don't know how we start talking about it afterwards. And I was on my high horse. I was very righteous. I was justifying why I did it and why I needed to do it. And then that reflection word came in. I started to really think about it. And I had some time to create a little bit of space. And I don't know if we had a conversation before I reflected or you put something in my ear and then I reflected. I can't remember. Mm-hmm. But I remember I came to the conclusion that I was wrong. And I needed to apologize. And I needed to do more than apologize. Mm-hmm. Right, because apologize is merely just saying I'm sorry, but I needed to face this woman and really hear how my words and actions impacted her, and how I can make that right. And that takes a lot of courage to clean that up. So J-Rod, my friend at the time, well, we wasn't that close, but I asked him to facilitate a restorative conversation where it was us three, and I had to sit there and listen to how my actions impacted. You know, my coworker. And then, you know, J-Rod facilitated a conversation and I was allowed to restore myself and to restore my sense of freedom and my sense of personal integrity. Mm-hmm. And that was very hard. And that changed me in that moment because I think I thought I had arrived, you know. And in that moment, I realized until the day I transitioned, you never arrive. It's just a journey.
Sure.
You know,
sure.
It's just a journey to be great.
Sure.
So I thank you for that. So I think that was one of the early examples of that sense of trust we had, that sense of transparency, and that sense of vulnerability.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know if you remember that story, but I just wanted to.
Absolutely. And yeah, I think just quickly, if I could share a story of the same nature, that just kind of reflects that, I think it would be the one where I, you know, just being a single father, raising my sons in my household, having my brother there was a lot of testosterone. In my home, and I had my sons were on a show earlier in the episodes, and my middle son, you know, we had a very tense interaction because we've had those interactions growing up, and it got to the point where it became physical, and you know, in a lot of cases that happens between sons and fathers. It has happened, you know, between me and my father, I'm sure between him and his father, and it was just one of those things that trickled down into the next generation, and it became physical, and it got bad to the point where, you know, I not only caused physical harm to my son, but I caused a lot of mental and emotional harm in that household. And I remember coming to you like, man, I messed up, man. I do you remember this? And
yes,
I was like,
I
messed up, and I was like, I need for you to come and facilitate this conversation between my sons and I, because I knew they weren't interested in hearing anything I had to say, because even though the physical part took place between me and my middle son, my other sons were there to witness it, and my brother was there to witness it, and I had been the captain of this ship for a long time. We all under one roof, and I'm, you know, it's my home, and you know, all these things are in my mind, and so it was like, I went physical. I didn't tap into my self-awareness. I didn't tap into the conversation piece. I just went physical because I felt like, oh, it was very audacious of him to be a certain way. And my mind, I just blanked. But you came in, man, and you were able to come in and talk about feelings and needs. And we had these conversations. And we were able to kind of restore the relationship between me and my son, or at least get on the path to restoration.
Yeah.
And my mom was there, and in that moment I was really thankful for you, because I had made a snap decision, you know, I had reacted, you know, and nonetheless, we were able to have this conversation as a family. You were able to come in as a friend, as my brother. And I've always appreciated you for that, and I've always appreciated that moment. So I think those are just two stories that kind of attest to who we are, who we've been to each other. And I think men get that, right? We need other men to be able to connect with, to be able to have conversations with, and other men to be able to say, hey, man, you tripping.
Challenge us.
You tripping.
Confront us when we wrong.
Hey, you tripping. We don't need men that's going to always say we right when we wrong. You know what I mean? We need men that's going to, like you say, challenge us, confront us to say, and we have to be comfortable enough as men to say, what you think? You think I was wrong? You know, and be able to take that. Yeah, you wrong. Yeah. Young, old, or in between, right? We should be able as men to have these conversations with men and even young men. Because a lot of times older men think we can't learn something from young men, and we can. We mentor young men all day, and I know for a fact I walk away with things from young men all
Absolutely.
The time.
Reciprocity.
You know?
It's about reciprocity.
Yes.
You know, giving and receiving equally. But to do that, you know, you have to be open, and everybody can. You know, it's tough. It's a struggle. It's a challenge to trust, to open yourself up. You know, that old adage in black families is what happens here stays here.
Sure.
Right? It's kind of like Vegas. You don't tell the family business.
Sure.
And how much do we suffer in silence?
That's right.
In our families, in our communities, because of just not willing to seek counsel.
Sure.
You know? But what we do is go for that first definition of freedom through self-medication, through entertainment. Not to say that's a bad thing, but anything in overabundance can be bad. But if you have to continue to recreate freedom over and over and over and over and over again, it's very temporary, it's fleeting. You got to ask yourself, is that really freedom?
And I think just, you know, in closing for me, I think I heard Denzel say something the other day. He said, the sins of the father are passed down to the son and from the son to the son. And I think at some point in time, we have to become aware of what it is we're passing down. And we have to become aware of how it's affecting those behind us. Because a lot of these things come down from generations and they're passed down through generations.
If it's hysterical, it's historical.
And so we have to be aware of not only what we receive, but what we're passing along, and make a conscious decision as men as to whether this is something we want to continue to pass along, or if it's something that needs to stop right here and be and changed, and then pass along a new message or a new habit or a new behavior. And so I thank you, man. I thank you. And I look forward to you coming back out and continuing this conversation. I know we want to make this a two-part conversation, so we'll be able to come out and have someone else join us, another good friend of ours, next time around.
Yeah,
but I appreciate your time, man, coming out, sharing your stories, sharing your time, sharing your wisdom, sharing your insight. Is there anything you'd like to say before you leave? And can you tell people how to contact you as well?
Yes, you can contact me on Instagram, The Real Mansa, TheRealMansa, or my email, which is Morris Irvin, MorisErvin at Yahoo. Facebook is also Morris Irvin. So again, my last quote is, you got to feel it to heal it and name it to tame it. Thank you so much, my brother. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Absolutely.
Appreciate you.
Thanks for coming. I love you, man.
Love you too.
And I will talk with you soon. Thank you all for joining in, and we'll see you next time right here on the Compassionate Manhood Podcast with J. Rod Johnson on KAZ Radio.
Peace.
Peace.